This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 11th day of February 2011 here in Japan, and I'm joined on the line from Canada by Aaron and Linda James, two people who have been involved in an ongoing struggle and ordeal with the U.S. and Canadian governments for the last 5 years regarding an incident that took place on Northwest Airlines flight in January of 2006. Aaron, James, thank you very much for joining us today on the program.
Thank you for having us here, James.
Well, I'd like to hear more in-depth about your case and some of the latest developments and some of the twists and turns, but I guess perhaps we should get everyone on the same page by going back to the beginnings of your incident and talk a little bit about how this all started.
In fact, that's a very good idea. However, I will start at the end, because of the fact that it paints a very broad span picture. We have the FBI's confession now at james-press.blogspot.com. Again, james-press.blogspot.com. Best viewable in Firefox until I take care of cross-border, cross-browser conflicts. We have in the first wireframe a confession from FBI Asset Private Investigator Stephen C. Davis, signed to 81st U.S. Attorney General Washington, D.C., Michael McCassie, now replaced under the Obama administration under Eric Holder, of course. That confession, copied to Washington, states the following. It states that local agencies, law enforcement, Winnipeg police, have been acting covertly in secret operations with the FBI to the advent of my abduction to the United States. B also states that these operations have been consistent with not only cross-border collusion, but with judicial fraud, particularly to all aspects concerning our case since the original racial profiling attack aboard Northwest Airlines in January 2006. Three, or C, respectively, it also states that, particularly to that judicial fraud, our attorney who represented us in a covert trial of the United States that housed members of covert agencies, including FBI and the jury pool, subsequent to the racial profiling attack on the airline, had conflict of interest and was working at the behest of the prosecution. That would be Carlson and Jones, our attorney Robert Jones. Now, I'll go back into the background of this. My mother and I made our way back to down to the United States for the first time to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. The purpose of our trip was to see about an injury to my arm, which I had sustained, over which we were contemplating surgery. And so we took a flight, I believe it was number 1628, Northwest Airlines. We took two connecting flights, one from Winnipeg to Minneapolis Airport, and then one from Minneapolis Airport to Rochester. Both were without incident, save for the fact that our baggage did not arrive off the carousel with us when we arrived, raising questions as to what had taken place. Northwest Airlines provided us a fraudulent supposition that perhaps had become displaced or misplaced, that it would be delivered to our hotel in Rochester when it was found. It was delivered, in fact, to our hotel 3 hours later in the following condition. Locks cut, baggage searched, and items rummaged about and displaced, with a note attached to it stating that this baggage has been seized, locks cut, and searched due to security concerns. Now, given the history in that subsequent, prior to our trip, we had noticed that TSA agents on the U.S. side of the airport, international airport terminal in Winnipeg, had been eyeing and scrutinizing my mother and I very suggestively, in particular my person, given the skin tone, my skin tone, my parents may lend one to believe that I'm perhaps of Arab descent or whatnot, given then raising all the alarm bells and whistles of those who are likened or predisposed to that kind of extremist paranoia and propaganda, which TSA agents today very much so are. Now, given that we suspected racial profiling, made a complaint at the TSA, at the terminal, Northwest Airlines terminal, upon our return trip after having stayed in Rochester 3 days to take care of, counsel with the practitioner to see about the injury to my arm. On our return trip 3 days later, we made an issue of this, finally, at the Northwest Airlines terminal, whereupon which, once I mentioned the words racial profiling, the attendant who had given me a complaint form to fill out quickly ripped it out from my hands without any warning and stated, oh, you won't be needing this, then you're going to sue. Now, that kind of reactionary response is reflective of the demographics within Minnesota. It's something, a very important point on which to elaborate. Now, here they are. Minnesota happens to be the highest Somali population, which is, if people aren't aware, of a Muslim sect in all the United States. The FBI go after Muslims like no other, as part of the false flag war on terror operation. In fact, there's just been a recent escapade regarding Northwest Airlines underwear bomber exposed as a false flag operation, for those who are unaware of Umar Farooq Abdulmutallab, who's seen getting on a board Northwest Airlines flight without any boarding pass, escorted by a sharp-dressed man who happened to be talking to the CIA in Christmas of 2009. Well, it was on Northwest Airlines that the event just, that I'm about to tell you took place, unfolded back in January 2006. So, complaining about this baggage that had not been treated very well, and the evidence of racial profiling, the attendant having ripped the complaint form out of my hand, I asked promptly for its return, whereupon it was returned to me. I finished submitting my complaint, gave it to them. And there was an entrapment that set in upon us, in that my mother was later accused of harboring a suspicious bag aboard the aircraft after having passed through security gates without incident, and either after attacked after the plane rerouted. I'm leaving out some events, but I'm going to go fill in the background on these demographics again. Not only is it the highest Somali population, not only is Northwest Airlines notorious for its involvement in false flag fiascos like the one I described prior with Abdulmutallab, but there are 21 blacks and/or Somalis in prison within Minnesota for every one person in the majority. It is the highest rate of over-prosecution of that sector, those group of individuals. As for the false flag war on terror, Northwest Airlines has been sued by the ACLU for systemic incidents of racial profiling, discriminatory behavior, and also in likeness of having KKK-based paraphernalia fraught throughout the workplace of their own black or Muslim employees working underneath their corporation, and pictures of nooses and whatnot, and they've been reprimanded on many occasions as such. Moreover, there had been a racial profiling program indoctrinated into the venue of the TSA agents at Minneapolis Bloomingdale Airport in the 6 months prior to our arrival, between June and December of 2006. That comes out of Israel under Ron Raffai, former head of Tel Aviv Airport, Israel Ben Gurion Airport, who introduced this egregious profiling program because of the demographics in Minnesota, thinking, as the FBI, CIA, and various TSA interests were concerned, that collectively thinking that, well, we had the highest, you know, per capita Somali, here we go after them. In any case, we have the highest per capita imprisonment of them, regardless, and so what better place to use this as a testing ground? Who's going to complain? So between June and December 2006, after having indoctrinated themselves, we were fresh targets for them insofar as their testing ground for their, you know, extremist behavior and extremist ideological profiling program. Noting that Northwest Airlines was also involved in 1996 in the egregious release of 6,000 passenger name records of PNRs to the FBI, along with NASA, and for the propagation of the CAPSR computer-assisted profiling system, which was, as you may note, well before 9/11, and 9/11, therefore, simply the effect rather than the cause, the excuse for these programs, and not the cause. Again, leaning again towards the ideology, this is a false flag operation and continuum thereof. So these are the demographics on board the aircraft. Again, after having been passed through security gates without any issue, my mother and I get on the aircraft, take our seats, and you're still with me here?
I guess so. I mean, it's an incredible mouthful, and I'm already quite lost, so I imagine the listeners are as well.
Again, I'm painting the demographics of a racially discriminatory atmosphere where there have been profiling venues and profiling propaganda based ideology, where the airline itself has been involved heavily within these profiling venues as per the demographics in Minnesota, housing the highest Somali population, and the FBI's notoriety for going after Somalis as part of the false flag operation.
Right. Okay, I've got that much. But just in terms of what actually happened to you, I still have absolutely no idea.
We're going to go back to that. After having passed through the security gates without issue, and after having boarded the aircraft, I was accused of harboring a suspicious bag by junior flight attendant Sherry Caudill. And she quickly dropped that as an issue. This incident had taken place while I was in the washroom. Upon my return from the washroom, Sherry Caudill and I crossed paths in the aisle, whereafter she followed me down the aisle by the problem. And what my problem was, it turned out that she was complaining that I hadn't acknowledged her in passing in the aisle. She had claimed that she had said hello to me, that I had not responded. I'm unaware to this day if she had in fact said anything, but regardless, even if she had, She raised the attention of the entire audience of the cabin, and that would have been the second time. I was unaware of the first occasion with my mother just prior, but she was verbally accosted just prior, as I told you, regarding the bag. I then took my, I apologized for, you know, apparently not having responded to her, to, you know, in front of the audience of the cabin, took my seat. My mother and I began discussing what was taking place. We noted that, you know, the treatment of our baggage on our way down, the scrutiny of our person by the TSA agents and whatnot, the note, the treatment that she'd received from the stewardess, the treatment that I'd received from the stewardess in the hallway, in the aisle, rather. And just at this point, stewardess Sherry Caudill came back to our seats, and we were sitting in row 8A and row and 8C, respectively, my mother and I. And she said, "Excuse me, are you talking about me?" And we were, you know, really taken aback at this point, because the fact that this was the, well, this was the third accost aboard the aircraft, and that in addition to the treatment of our baggage and our persons prior. And finally, I just said, "You know, I really think that will be quite enough from you." And those were my exact words. I said, "Thank you." And just to emphasize the fact that, you know, there's really no excuse for making an issue of this. This is your issue, not ours. And she responded, "Well, I think that you shouldn't be on this air. Well, I don't think you should be on this aircraft. I'm going to have to go and talk to the captain," were her words. And then she went back and spoke to her senior flight attendant, Beverly Banks, in the lobby area. And we heard some arguing and some defiance on the part of Caudill, stating emphatically, I didn't do anything, etc. And finally, the open PA system switched on. And over the open PA system, Sherry Caudill stated emphatically, "These people are lunatics." And again, the entire audience of the cabin would have heard that, which would have been, you know, the, I guess, the fourth accost, a verbal accost that we'd sustained within a matter of only minutes. It became clear to us, to our perspective, and from people who have also heard this account, that there seems to have been a deliberate intent to villainize us in one way, one form or another. And Northwest Airlines was under bankruptcy protection at the time, as well as the fact that it has ties to the Republican administration. Northwest Airlines former CEO Fred Malik was, was campaign co-chair for John McCain in the 2008 election, lobbied for the McCain, the Bush administration, George Herbert Walker in 1992, George W. Bush in 2004, and is a senior financier to the Bush Library Foundation. There have been multiple attempts on our abduction. I'm just jumping ahead a little bit in the timeline to make this poignant. Multiple attempts upon our abduction, given our protest of the attack that I'm about to describe, which were consistent with the receipt of threatening emails from the FBI that were carbon copied to John McCain, which we have embedded on the main webpage at james-press.blogspot.com, again noting that Firefox is required for proper view at this point. Now, going ahead, we were approached then by the senior flight attendant, Beverly Banks, who came back and spoke to us and asked us what had happened. She made no mention of the verbal accost over the open PA system, leaving me to wonder why that hadn't been brought up. But I simply said, "We wish to have no further contact with the junior stewardess because of the fact that she's been abusive." And she went back and spoke to the captain and whatnot. And finally, we noted that the plane was turning itself about, rerouting itself back to the airport terminal. It turns out a false report of irate passenger, despite the fact that I actually never raised my voice, was released to the airport police, Minneapolis Airport Police, and by the pilot. And once this occurred, we noticed that there were five Minneapolis Airport police officers aboard the aircraft. In saying so, there was a trial that later ensued. I'm just jumping ahead briefly. The senior flight attendant, Beverly Banks, confirms that, quote, "James, myself, remained calm and composed at all times." So the report of irate passenger was fraudulent. But the officers did board the aircraft and asked me to get up out of my seat, and did so. And at that point, I asked them, "Am I under arrest? Am I being charged? Have I committed any crime?" They answered, "No, sir, you have not," to all three questions, and then told me to get off the aircraft. And at that point, I'm thinking, well, this is odd. May I ask then under what or whose authority you're acting in, and under the conditions that I have not committed any crime by your estimation, and I'm not being obviously detained, I'm not under arrest. There was silence, so I finally asked the question again. You have a legal right to that as a citizen or even a guest. And their response was simply, "Cuff him." They all lunged in to attack and lunged for the injured arm, for which I'd gone down to the Mayo Clinic to seek surgery. I instinctively pulled back, and then they took out their taser. They felt this gave them license to proceed with even a more heinous and vicious style assault, and began poking and prodding me with 50,000-volt apparatus, which has killed hundreds of people across the United States in its notoriety and record. Ultimately, I stopped blocking the taser because I was concerned, well, if they have that, what else do they have? And what are they, you know, are they going to shoot me or whatnot? I put my hands to my side, and the officer looked almost startled by the fact that, you know, that I was actually, that I'd stopped, you know, trying to block their taser. And he said, he kind of shrugged his shoulders, and he prodded me with the taser, poked me with the taser. Very painful. I went down onto the taser, collapsed, and I laid deliberately with my hand by my side on the floor. To my surprise, the elite officer bent down and continued tasing me in his written report by his own admission for a period of over 10 seconds, in fact, exactly 10 seconds in his statement over my left chest, which is how he describes it. Anyone who knows any anatomy knows the left chest is the heart. They attempted to kill me. It's because, again, if you take a look back at the Robert Szukanski case, they only took three or four sharp blasts from the taser that were not held for any prolonged length of time. For it to kill him, and these individuals held it there for a lengthy period of time. My mother sat on in amazement and in horror, disillusion, and finally, when they realized that she was with me, they tried to keep her aboard the aircraft. They tried to illegally confine her to the aircraft, telling her that she'd have to go back to Canada without me. She couldn't come with me, etc. In fact, the officer, his mouth, his head dropped in shock because, in fact, he realized that there was an individual within family as witness to their hate crimes. What it came down to. Noting the background of Northwest Airlines with the racial profiling, the Minneapolis police are also notorious for scandalous lawsuit against them via their own officers, their own black officers, for their receipt of KKK-based threats upon their lives through their interdepartmental email boxes. So we have a conglomerate of basically hate-based ideology and factions amongst, you know, FBI, Northwest Airlines, and the Minneapolis Airport Police, Minneapolis Police. Having said that, they also assumed that we weren't together via the fact that there is segregation in Minnesota as part of the demographics, which is why it's important to underscore those demographics. Given that 21 blacks to one white in prison is very, very few and far between to find blacks and whites together. My mother happens to be Caucasian. I'm of mixed ethnicity, and so leading them to suspect that I was alone. And they realized I was not, and they had witnesses to their crime and tried to cover it up. Officers released only 3 or 5 reports. They gave the mother only 4 or 5 badge numbers after the account. They rearranged their positions on board the aircraft and gave fictitious reports that were self-contradictory even amongst themselves as evidence of their lies and deceptions, and accused me of assaulting one of them. Well, in Minneapolis, Communities United Against Police Brutality has a lawyer with whom they are in close association by the name of Jill Clark, who states very definitively once an individual, especially one of color, minority, is attacked by the police, the police try to villainize the individual or victim through the media in the false release of false reports, and that she refers to as the thousand cuts smear tactic. Well, falsified reports were released to the media as such by the Minneapolis police. In fact, 42 online accounts were found as such within the first week, and including newspaper, television, and radio. And subsequently, I was held 9 days, no Miranda, and I received threats from the FBI interrogation, where they handed out the names of various Middle Eastern-sounding individuals while I was being held, and these photographs, they gave me the names and photographs, I suppose, of several individuals who one might expect were of some kind of Middle Eastern background, asking me if I had any association with them or knew of them. And, of course, the implication is obvious, you know, trying to paint me out to be a terrorist or in association with them. And my calling card was made dysfunctional during that time. You have a calling card given to you in order to be able to call out to power of attorney, to family or associates. And not only was I held no Miranda rights, again, there was never any formal arrest made, and I was never charged with obstruction of justice as a corroborative point to that effect. They also imposed further implied threat and intimidation by disabling my calling card, my access to outside communication, as if to say, no one knows that you're here, no one knows what you're doing, and you have no outside communication. Are you going to talk to us, or are we going to employ other methods? That's basically what it was. So I told them whatever they wanted to know. I gave a complete history of my background, etc., where I had, where I you know, growing up, where my education was, etc. No, I wasn't associated with any of the Middle Eastern names or faces that they'd shown me, etc. Finally, they seemed convinced of this and left. During that time, I received threats from guards. There was an element of humiliation involved, stripped of your clothing, etc., forced to stay and sleep with the lights on, which is considered torture in and of itself. I was carted about from one area to the other, from Hennepin County to Sherburne County, handcuffed by wrist, ankle, and waist. There was just a general atmosphere of threatened intimidation that was meant to demoralize the human spirit. After the nine-day no Miranda, put on a no-fly list and sent back home, 14-hour bus ride. When we got back, we found FBI agent Mark Wrench outside our home on our belt the February the 13th of 2006. Again, just evidence of FBI illegal operations within Canada. And he'd been surveillancing us outside my home in order to gain a definitive position of my whereabouts. I guess, obviously, for the abduction ploys that would take place later on, a year and a half later, they wanted to be sure they knew where I was or whatnot. Subsequent to that, began trying to contact government legal counsel. There was a petition made by MP Stephen Fletcher, a Tories MP, to Peter McKay that went ignored, as did our complaints and our appeals to the ACLU, to Manitoba Human Rights, to Amnesty International, Foreign Affairs. In fact, the Foreign Affairs official, I think her name was Estelle Arnaud Batandier, had told me during my 9-day illegal no Miranda detention, while I still sat there bleeding, in fact, "Let us know if they torture you or force you to commit indecent acts. This is a U.S. affair. We will not be involved." That is a direct contraindication to Foreign Affairs' stated mandate on their own website, which is a fact that was discovered by our journalist Leslie Hughes, who attempted to contact Estelle, the Canadian consular representative in Minnesota, whereupon Estelle was extremely evasive and refused to speak with her. And so subsequent to that, there were a few months that went by when there was just a torrent of threats and intimidation, silent listener phone calls, erased voicemail messages, threats out on answering machines. Legal mail, registered legal mail, was intercepted from the African African Canadian Legal Clinic, Colin Brown, with the contents parched and removed. The envelope parched, the contents removed, with a note appended to it from Canada Post that said, "We apologize for this incident," etc., and so forth. That's a felony level act in of itself, interception of registered legal mail. Now, having said that, we received no less than 5 plea bargain offers in and amidst this torrent of threats and intimidation, as if to say, "Just sign here to your false guilt and whatnot, and we'll stop harassing you in this way and terrorizing your friends and your family." It wasn't just myself. It was anybody who had been in association with us trying to assist us. A friend of mine, Alan Wright, had made a call to the office of David L. Drake, pretrial services officer, inquiring about our case in the month prior to trial. He received a return of call from an unidentified number that said, "Stay out of our way if you know what's good for you, or else." And that's basically the "or else" part wasn't said, but it was "stay out of our way, or if you know what's good for you." And it was just very obvious that this was all very much illegal protocol. There was a 95% conviction rate in the United States at the federal level, and which is representative of threats, intimidation, illegal covert surveillance, and tactics such as those imposed upon our family. Finally, at trial, we found that we were in the midst of no less than what you would call a psyops. The jury pool, again, this trial was in order to attempt to incriminate me as someone having committed an act against Minneapolis Airport Police aboard the aircraft in capacity, their accusation, assault on a police officer, which was itself a cover-up for the hate-based attack, which we had sustained. Now, on this jury pool, we found that there were members and or affiliates of the following: FBI, Northwest Airlines employees, conveniently, given that was the airline on which we were attacked, Minneapolis police, Minneapolis Airport police, military, prosecuting attorneys, family of murder victims, and I think there was one individual whose cousin was an NSA. So that is corroborated by the minutes of the hearing, which we have in our possession, which is detailed During the course of jury selection, it is required that all individuals give their backgrounds, and so we have those backgrounds stated as a matter of public court record and scanned in on the main webpage, again, as I stated prior. The judge, David Astori, a criminally charged ex-U.S. Marine, involved in a fraudulent affair with having conflict of interest in a case involving IBM, in which he had his wife had invested stock within IBM, and he was presiding over a case in which an individual was had claim against IBM for fraudulent release of their persons from employment. That person lost their case, and what Judge Doty said in the middle of the courtroom is, you know, if you don't come back for your sentencing, oh yes, there was a guilty finding, I'll go into that, but what other finding could there be in that kind of forum? If you don't come back for your sentencing, I'll send the U.S. Marshals out to get you. We have a very good relationship with Canada right now. And he went on noting the history of the FBI with our persons. He said, by the way, Hollywood overdoes the FBI, but not the U.S. Marshals, every bit the bloodhounds they're portrayed to be. You don't come back, I'll send them out to get you. Do you understand? Well, the fraudulent finding, they attempted to find me guilty of a felony-level, you know, gross violation, felony-level assault, a severe protracted injury were the technical terms, legal terms, which carried a 9-year prison sentence. That did not go through. One of the reasons why is because one of the officers did not involve himself in the attack, Alvin Cooper, who happened to be the only black officer amongst them involved, by the way, and so you can read into that what you will. He referred to me as the victim on the stand, properly. So, of course, he wasn't going to be party to their lies. And he's now doing night shift duty, whereas he was an active employee by day. There was some evidence of reprimand for his position taken on stand. But he also refused to submit a report, and where any other officers had submitted a report, fraudulent reports. And there was also the conflicting testimony between the stewardess, the junior stewardess, Sherry Caudill, and Beverly Banks. And Sherry Caudill had stated that I had been yelling and had been cantankerous and loud on the aircraft, whereas senior stewardess Beverly Banks had stated that I'd been calm and composed at all times, etc. And so even amongst this, you know, prejudicial jury pool, they weren't all members of the covert agencies, even though they tried to stack the deck as much as they could. They were members of the general public, which is what's actually legally required, that you be tried by members of your peers, which did not happen. But there were enough of them that there was at least some measure of justice, even given the fact that I was threatened into silence at trial and unable to testify on my own behalf. That's right. We had submitted our complaint to peace officer standards and training in the week and month prior to the trial. They had taken the liberty of submitting our complaint to the FBI and the prosecuting attorney, whereupon the court deemed it anti-U.S. government, which is just more further evidence of the attack on the right to open court, of course, this, you know, evidence of this Patriot Act being applied. And I was told that if I, you know, wished to present my case, that my complaint will be represented as inflammatory and anti-U.S. government before a council whose representation spans the members of the covert agencies of the United States. This is what our attorney said in the back room while he was mocking our position and the fact that he was the best friend of the prosecuting attorney. So he, Robert Jones, stated that, are you sure you want to testify? And look at the jury pool. And, you know, by the way, my friend, I think it was Chris Wilton, who was the prosecuting attorney. He and I slammed back a few together, played hockey together when we were growing up, et cetera, et cetera. Well, FBI agent Stephen Davis, this affidavit that he had submitted to Washington attests to judicial fraud, particularly to all aspects concerning our case, the conflict of interest between the prosecuting attorney and our defense attorney at trial, and the fact that now, well, let's get to the next point. After the trial and the fraudulent finding of misdemeanor, there was a misdemeanor finding. The felony level of assault charge didn't go through, but a misdemeanor finding was found. So that misdemeanor charge was actually added the day before trial because the prosecution was concerned that, given the evidence that we had against them, that the jury, even as stacked as it was, wouldn't find, and they would be found having, you know, submitted fraudulent testimony, submitted fraud, you know, egregious or frivolous actions against me to the law system. And we were informed that this secret meeting had taken place between the prosecution, the FBI, and Minneapolis Airport Police 3 days before the trial by our attorney, who was working with them, because that's how he got a document from the prosecuting attorney that was an interdepartmental police report document that gave evidence that there had been five officers on board instead of four. That's because we had submitted a complaint. In our complaint that we had submitted to Peace Officer Standards and Training, we had outlined the fact that we knew there were five officers, not four, that only three or five reports had been submitted, and that only four or five badge numbers had been given. Well, the prosecuting attorney was made aware of this through that report, and our attorney was made aware of this. And so in order to remove that as an argument that we might have against them, the prosecuting attorney gave our attorney, who he was working with, a document, found the Minneapolis interdepartmental reports that gave evidence of the fifth officer, Officer Alvin Cooper. And the reason that they didn't want to have him involved, because he was the only officer who didn't involve himself, he was the only black officer, he called him the victim on the stand, et cetera, and so forth. He was a red herring for them. They didn't want to be, you know, muddying up their lies in collusion. So that, having said that, following the fraudulent finding of misdemeanor, which is not a, keep in mind, is not a felony level finding, the FBI put me on their website, FBI.gov, major crimes, which we found online, and it's also available on the website. And in doing some research into FBI agent Mark Wrench, we found that he was head of his division for the major offenders division, and so when he didn't get his fraudulent finding of felony level assault, he just put it up on the internet as such, regardless. Just to let you know, the FBI had been found guilty by Judge Gladys Kessler, who's a senior federal court judge in the United States, and there's an online website to this effect, of collusion between the FBI and the U.S. Department of Justice to the advent of judicial tyranny and the illegal representation of cases, the use of fictitious information, fraudulent evidence, and the tampering of said evidence. And so that's just representative of what went on there. Now, all of this, keeping in mind, I've been attacked, left in full blood in the aircraft, villainized through the Minneapolis Airport Police, villainized through the media, threatened, my family and friends threatened, my friends and associates threatened, placed through covert trial, and threatened by the judge that he would come back and attempt my abduction, which eventually he did through the local agencies here in Canada. We finally went online, began lobbying extensively against Northwest Airlines, just fastidiously against the Minneapolis Airport Police, the FBI, and whatnot. Immediately we received cyber threats on our YouTube and Blogger accounts in response. And one of them said, you're pissing people off and creating enemies. You're best to, you know, again, the same thing they did to my friend Alan Bright when he called the David L. Drake, a threatening response. Stay out of our way, et cetera, don't talk about us. I had that threat scanned in as well. And one of them was a communication apparently from Sherry Coghill herself on our YouTube account, said don't believe him, et cetera, et cetera. We suspect that may have been just the FBI using her name in order to, you know, instill their lies and propaganda. We have no idea if that was in fact her. We received another communication from Agent 94394. So they're making it very clear that this is that there's going to be some retaliation of a very, you know, untoward and informal nature in response. And finally, what we found online was the evidence thereof. We found Kilbushite's websites. What is a Kilbushite website? We found several websites that gave detail of radical, you know, what you call radical jihadist al-Qaeda rhetoric laced throughout that advocated for the plot towards the assassination of then-President Bush. At the top of those web pages, retroactively embedded, we found my name and the website of our then-primary website, AaronJamesStory.com. Embedded at the top of no less than six of such websites, which we have, again, scanned in on our current web page, james-press.blogspot.com, under the main link, summary targeting from the FBI. But that aside, I immediately realized, as of September the 28th of 2007, that the FBI had intended to target me thusly in order to allow themselves a measure of leverage against us insofar as, you know, their bid to extradite me to the United States. They didn't have any. You see, the thing is, a misdemeanor is not grounds for extradition to the United States. A felony level charge against someone is grounds. Plus, against the United States, the U.S. president, of course, is a felony level offense. And so we immediately saw that the entrapment unfolding, and I made it aware. We presented this, our concerns, to Rock Tessé, the president of the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group. on the 27th or 28th of September, in an attempt to have him acknowledge our disclaimer to said material, which he did so in reply as official record, and we received his response on October the 2nd, and it was only weeks later, on October the 27th of 2007, that the initial abduction attempt, which I had predicted within several weeks, took place. Officers within the Winnipeg Police Force convened about my apartment. There were at least 10 of them in the hallway and several cruisers outside, and they threatened to break down the door. Upon opening the door, after making several emergency phone calls to my journalist family, friends, and those within the activist community, I opened the door to find that there were 10 of them, each with pistols pointed at my head. They said, our boss said, they handcuffed me in broad daylight, put me into their vehicle, took me down to their headquarters, and they then began threatening my abduction to the United States. And they said, well, you know, our boss says that Minneapolis has unfinished business with you, and that we're aware that we have Minneapolis police come up here to train all the time. Our boss says maybe we should leave you locked up here long enough for one of them to come up and get you. Some background is required here. Winnipeg Police Chief Keith McCaskill is president of the Northwest Chapter Associates FBI with affiliation with Minneapolis Police Law Enforcement. That's number one. Here, that therein is his motive as proxy agent for the FBI as far as sequestering my illegal render to the United States. Number two, well, we caught him lying in his test before City Hall that he knew nothing of our case. Before City Councilor Harvey Smith, he made this claim. I have Harvey's verbal attest to that in an audio recording that I have embedded in Flash MP3 player format on our website at james-press.blogspot.com. And just beneath that, I have a two-page Refusal of Freedom of Information Act request. That was a Freedom of Information Act request particular to police notes of October 27th, 2007, the date upon which police made their first attempt upon my abduction. So again, sequester of those notes was made by our attorney, and it was returned by Chief Keith McCaskill personally with his personal signature on a Refusal of Freedom of Information Act request as of I think it was February of 2008. Now, that is, of course, in completely contradictory to his attest that he knew nothing of our case. In fact, as the abduction attempts continued during the election year, noting the ties between Northwest Airlines, the FBI, John McCain, and the Bush administration, that's why I refer to the attempts as having taken place during the election year, there were a slew of attempts that took place between July 5th and July the 9th, July 5th, 9th, and 10th, actually, after which our attorney placed a personal warning to Chief Keith McCaskill and all sergeants within the Winnipeg Police Force that they would be charged if continuing in or successful upon the illegal render of my person to the United States. And so, of course, McCaskill has been caught lying and false profess of his lack of awareness of our case, lack of knowledge. The reason that Winnipeg Police brought up Minneapolis Police is not only given Keith McCaskill's position as president of the Northwest Chapter of Associates FBI, not only given his position as having affiliation with Minneapolis law enforcement, but also given the fact that I had placed websites up online that were critical not only of the FBI, but also of the Minneapolis Police in the context of the hate-based lawsuit and scandalous affairs against, scandalous lawsuit against them regarding the KKK-based activities. As a context within the scandalous affairs of the FBI and Northwest Airlines, and our journalist Leslie Hughes of Canadian Dimension magazine, who had put out a report on regarding our ordeal, had told us that she called the Minneapolis Airport Police Office, and without any prompting, they were already aware of our website. And so, you can imagine, read into the threat. We have Minneapolis police come here to train all the time. Emphatically, as if you know, we're going to get you back for this, online smear campaign, is what it was by the, from their perspective. And even though the all statements that were made against them, that I've made against them, are completely legitimate and backed by evidence. So it was a very retaliatory measure, and a retaliatory measure involving the fact that it involved not just the consternation of the FBI and the Minneapolis police, but involved the Republican Party in their bid in the 2008 election as a whole. The fact that those elements played a very large part is reflected in threats received from the FBI, carbon copied to John McCain, in and amidst the attempts upon my abduction during the election year. Here is the background. After the first attempt upon my abduction, made by the Winnipeg police, there were a slew of further attempts made within rapid succession. These attempts were meant to affect my abduction prior to a court hearing, which the Winnipeg police were trying to avoid. In that court hearing, there was to be, and was, the investigation of Winnipeg police involvement with the FBI and other U.S. agencies in this case, as stated in Agent Davis' affidavit, to the effect of my illegal render to the United States. They wanted desperately to remove the primary witness to those investigations, that being myself, prior to the first court date. The Winnipeg police chief at the time, the acting co-chief prior to McCaskill, Menno Zacharias, resigned one day before the first hearing. the day after the first hearing, FBI agent Stephen C. Davis came onto the scene with a friend of the court petition, the one that I had alluded to at the beginning of this interview, copied to 81st U.S. Attorney General Washington Michael McCassey, that admitted that, of course, the Winnipeg police were involved in secret dealings with the FBI and other U.S. agencies, and in our case, particular to my abduction, admitted to the judicial fraud and our attorney's conflict of interest with the prosecution. It admitted all. Now, why did he do that? The thing is, that same agent is the one who later sent us threatening communication copied to McCain. Why would he admit all of this malfeasance? The reason is it was an FBI sting operation. He wanted to convince our attorney to buy into his trust. He was the FBI's mechanism of infiltration into the investigations of the FBI within Canada. So he wanted to, basically, the FBI wanted us to have him on our team, so to speak, insofar as these investigations, so that he could muddy the waters for the FBI and for the Winnipeg police, who were tied to them through Keith McCaskill, President, Northwest Chapter Associates FBI. So he gave our attorney this fraudulent, this disingenuous friend of the court petition, wherein he said, let me assist you in your sequester of justice and whatnot on behalf of Aaron James. Our attorney, as the rest of the activist community, saw right through that and stated, well, we don't think we want you to have you on our team. You seem somewhat disingenuous. By his communications through email, he was by his use of words, it was very obvious he was not acting in our best interest and had ulterior motives. Finally, after he realized that he would not be successful in that active infiltration, thereafter, Hyde and Jekyll, Hyde turned to Jekyll, and the threatening communication copied McCain came shortly thereafter, 2 weeks later, as of March the 4th. In fact, that threatening communication came 2 weeks after a threatening communication on February the 14th, which he made by phone, in which he stated, it would be a shame if anything were to happen to your mother. Of course, it wouldn't be me, although I can't control the entire FBI. You should know about my good friendship with John McCain. Let's blame everything on your attorney. In other words, help me cover things up, or something is going to happen to your family. By the way, the Republican Party is involved. Here's how. And you're better off not to cross us and try to expose us any further, or there will be, consequences for your person and your family. He threatened my abduction and my mother's life in the context of his association with the Republican Party, John McCain, noting their mutual association between they, Northwest Airlines, and the Bush administration. And that marked the fourth or fifth attempt upon my abduction, of which there were 14 made during the election year. And now, subsequent to that, more recently, there's been incident where outward stalking and threats and intimidation that are continuing to the present day. I'll evidence the incidents of June the 9th of 2010. There was an agent who identified himself as member of the JTF, or Joint Task Force, who approached my mother and I at a bus stop. He claimed that he'd been waiting there for us, even though we had been there. We had arrived there at that location after he did. He stated, "No, I was. Even though you arrived at this bus track after I did, I'm the one who walked in on you." He was implying that he'd been waiting there for us, and this was late in the evening, about 9:30 or 10 o'clock. And what he said is, he acknowledged that, or he professed to be an agent of the JTF. joint task force, special forces that are operating with CSIS in Afghanistan towards the advent of the torture of Afghan detainees in Bagram and Kandahar. We had been having a conversation, my mother and I, just about that very thing because of Peter McKay's involvement in silencing reports that were presented to him through it was Richard Colvin that gave the reports regarding he is a present Canadian foreign diplomat in Afghanistan. He presented evidence to Peter McKay that Canada was involved with the United States in the torture of Afghan detainees, and we were discussing that because of course Peter McKay's direct involvement in our case and the threat to point my mother's life, my abduction to torture that had been made through the agencies. We had mentioned all of this detail on our phone line, which is tapped, the day before, and that was the first day that we had mentioned the JTF in any context whatsoever. And it was the very day after that this agent had said, you know, yes, we're following you, and I'm JTF. In other words, read between the lines. Your phone line is tapped, and we're listening to what you're saying, and the government don't appreciate it. Now, tied to Agent Davis, if you go on to StopZion.com, you'll see that there are a number of senior U.S. senators to which he is affiliated. One of them is Kit Bond. Kit Bond is made notorious via his support of current CIA head Leona Panetta in the support of Panetta's favorable position on enhanced interrogation and torture, which is why Kit Bond supported him, as well as his affiliation with Senator Orrin Hatch, who is a very strong proponent of the Bush administration, the Iraq War, et cetera, and so forth. And so, given Davis' threats upon our persons, we're taking this very seriously, given his connections, self-professed, to John McCain, the Republican Party, as well, and that we receive a threatening communication from him to John McCain. Everything ties together. Now, going back to Peter McKay, the first attempt upon my abduction took place after our meeting with senior members of the Canadian government. And what Stephen Davis also said is, we are working eagerly with the Canadian government to see about your rendition to the United States. That was the same conversation on February 14th where he stated that, my mother's life was in danger because of his threats upon her life, my abduction and whatnot were implied in that same conversation. Now, if you ever read the book Canada Becomes Israel or heard of it, it's by Eve Engler. And Eve Engler talks about Canada's notoriety and its complicity with Israel-based profiling initiatives. In fact, Canada has just lost its place on the United Nations Foreign Advisory Council because of its egregious ties to Israel-based mandate of that like. And the fact is that the first attempt upon my abduction came shortly after the release of the Wayne Madsen report from Washington, D.C., which you'll see in the main page at james-press.blogspot.com. It was critical of the Israeli-based profiling initiatives under which my mother and I were assailed in Minneapolis in January of 2006. The first attempt upon my abduction came also just prior to the release of Leslie Hughes' article, our current journalist from Canadian Dimension magazine, which was equally critical of the profiling initiative based out of Israel under which we were afflicted. Now, tied to that and tied to Canada's position and allegiance to Israeli-based profiling initiatives, that's being even further motive insofar as sequester of my abduction in and amongst, consistent with the timing and the release of these reports, is the fact that John McCain is connected to the Jewish World Congress and through mandates and interests tying in with Israel. John McCain is connected to these through his wife, Cindy McCain, who is daughter of Jim Hensley, who is himself a henchman under Kemper Marley in Arizona State, who is himself simply a frontman for Meyer Lansky and the Bronfman family, noting that Edgar J. Bronfman was president of the Jewish World Congress until his resignation in August of 2006. And so that report is found on PiperReport.com. And so when you tie in the fact that Northwest Airlines introduced this heinous-based racial profiling initiative under the Israeli flag under Ron Raphael, Canada's and U.S. mutual allegiance to Israel, these reports being released, our contact with government officials, and there you go, I'm being abducted, threatened against, my mother's life against John McCain's association with the FBI, et cetera, via Stephen C. Davis and whatnot. And you see this affidavit from Davis that says, by the way, it's all fraudulent, we've been trying to kidnap him, and, we confess. That affidavit, that submission was given just prior to multiple attempts made on my abduction. The public was never meant to see that affidavit before Washington, that was signed before Washington and submitted. That affidavit was meant to be simply for the view of our personal attorney, Stephen Davis, and myself, and I was meant, not to be heard nor seen of shortly thereafter in light of the abduction attempts that pursued there that took place thereafter, and so that has backfired on them because of the fact that the abduction attempts were not successful. What we have left is their open confession online to their self-professed tyranny and their illegal actions, illegal covert operations and clandestine activities, 5 years ongoing. And again, for Firefox users, and again, I apologize for the time being, james-press.blogspot.com requires Firefox for proper view. In the iframe that gives detail of Davis' affidavit, which he submitted to Washington, in the links that I have embedded between those documents, you will see Agent Davis' personal attest to his ties to the Bush family through his father, Dr. H. Clive Davis, who refers to as a geologist for the Bush family, and Dr. H. Clive Davis' ties personally to George W. Bush. He is given this through open admission on as part of a co-op radio program with his crony Reginald Angus Argue. He originally attempted to have Reginald Angus Argue refer us to him as his method of infiltration into our circle. So again, Reginald Angus Argue was used as a point of contact for Davis and attempting to basically have Reginald point us in Davis' direction as someone who could potentially provide advocacy. That was part of the FBI sting operation. And so on YouTube, within the webpage, you can see that Reginald Angus Argue is interviewing Stephen Davis and boasting about his ties to the Bush family, to the Reagan administration. At StopZion.com, you will see a 1976 still shot of Ronald Reagan standing next to Agent Stephen C. Davis. This is how high up this goes. Noting Ronald Reagan's personal ties to the false war on terror and his ties to Hussein in the anybody who knows their history will know that Ronald Reagan, the Bush administration, and Britain sold Saddam Hussein arms within the 80s, with which he gassed his own people and the Iranians, and to say nothing of Reagan's eugenics-based ideology, which is represented in Agent Davis and the FBI within their own hate-based ideology under which we are now currently being afflicted as minorities under the false flag Operation War on Terror. So all of this is very closely dovetailed.
Aaron, you have an incredible story, and it's quite mind-boggling in its scope, but I'm afraid we are out of time for our hour today. So I wonder what you'd like the listeners at home to take out of this or what type of help you'd be seeking from people.
Well, on the main webpage at james-press.blogspot.com, in the court documents, you will see that police, in light of their attempt on my abduction, in the context of that, illegally sent things to Minneapolis, that our attorney attested that these actions were illegal, that the entire thing was a facade, which Agent Davis inadvertently admits, and that we had backed them out of court because they were trying to cover things up, which they successfully did so because of the complicity of Judge Ginsburg in the Manitoba Law Courts. And so we are currently subject to these illegal operations, these clandestine activities ongoing, and this harassment. We were just recently approached just days prior, so the 30th of January, by a self-admitted member of the U.S. Marine Force who interrupted a meeting between our journalist, Leslie Hughes, my mother, and I in order to confront and inject intimidation. We need people to look at this material, to stand up, to contact us, to assist in us having contacting other venues for, for justice, other NGOs who can, take us to a higher level. We need a forum. Again, the justice is circularly, the tyranny is circular. it's circular tyranny in that there is no forum for this, given the fact that the courts and the system are the ones who are directly involved. This goes right up to the upper echelons within the Bush administration, and so where do you go to seek justice? Unfortunately, though, the evidence is so compelling that it can't be ignored. And for the interest of the general public, it mustn't be. This is something that, I mean, look at the TSA violations of today. In our case, you see the context in which how far it can and has gone. The average citizen is at risk. Civil liberties and dignities are at risk. Police state, brutalities, violations, and, dare I say, fascistic mentalities and ideologies are roaming rampant and unchecked. This is not just our story. It is a story that everyone should concern themselves with, and we would hope that they would do so. We would hope that they would contact us and assist us in contacting others who are in a position to leverage justice against the tyranny under which our family has been besieged. That is our request. You can send me personally email through my website at james-press.blogspot.com. There's a number of sharing options for Twitter, MySpace, and other sharing options that are embedded there. And you can embed our website animator, which is basically an RSS feed of updates to our ordeal. Keeping in mind, the web page must be viewed in Firefox until I correct for the cross-browser compatibility over the next several days, and after which can be properly viewed in cross-browser. But this is exemplary of all of the ideologies involved: globalization, cross-border collusion, North American Union, SPP, police state brutality, government corruption at the highest levels, corporate corruption. Fascism is basically the entity where government, corporation, and government, judiciary, and state involve themselves in jointly coadjuting and working against the interests of the individual. And so this is what we want people to see our case as a context, a microcosm of the macrocosm of
right. World. Okay, world I see. Corruption. Well, Aaron James, james-press.blogspot.com. We're out of time, but thank you very much for taking the time to stop by and explain your situation.
Thank you very much, James.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be with you.